Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, on May 31st, the Israeli military attacked a flotilla of boats full of civilians attempting to deliver humanitarian supplies to the Gaza Strip and to call attention to the impact of Israel's blockade. At least 9 and as many as 16 activists were killed, we don't know in part due to Israel's tight control over the flow of information. We'll talk with James Zogby of the Arab American Institute about Gaza. Also on the show, a new U.S. report says that most of the detainees held on Guantanamo since Obama took office should be released. That's after nearly 3/4 of those originally held had already been released under the Bush administration. This has enraged many on the right who are conducting a campaign targeting the detainees and even their U.S. lawyers. We'll talk to Scott Horton, contributing editor at Harper's and the magazine's No Comment blogger. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
You might remember the infamous Acorn videos, where right-wing activists released heavily edited and misleading tapes of themselves visiting offices of the community organizing group. The hoaxers said they told Acorn that they were a pimp and a prostitute, and Acorn gave them advice on how to cheat on their taxes. The slightest bit of checking revealed that was a lie, checking the corporate media almost never bothered to do. But the video maker, James O'Keefe, is still being treated seriously, judging by his June 1st appearance on ABC's Good Morning America. Host George Stephanopoulos introduced the interview this way. Quote, James O'Keefe became a media sensation after he and a friend posed as a pimp and a prostitute and secretly recorded Acorn workers giving them advice on how to cheat on their taxes, close quote. Again, that's false. You'd think by now journalists would know this. But Stephanopoulos went out of his way to praise O'Keefe, quote, I have to give you credit for this. On Acorn, you did expose people doing things they shouldn't do, close quote. Journalists normally don't give credit to people who lie to them, or at least they're not supposed to. O'Keefe's publisher, Andrew Breitbart, was also on hand, and when it was mentioned that none of the Acorn workers did anything illegal, he protested. Quote, is it legal to help set up a prostitution ring in every single office? Close quote. But Stephanopoulos let that slide, too. It's worth pointing out that the point of the ABC interview was to tout O'Keefe's latest videos attacking census workers. So the guy who created hoax videos that were treated like real journalism by a gullible media has a new batch of videos that are being taken seriously, again, by a gullible media.
For many people, the incredible devastation of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill and the revelation of patently inadequate oversight of the company and the process by regulatory agencies are undeniable. Something has to change. But not so fast, say corporate media wise men like the New York Times' David Brooks. It's all much more complicated than you sorts understand. Brooks's May 28th column sighed that the debate over the disaster has fallen into, quote, predictably partisan and often puerile categories, close quote, one of which is the liberal view that the government should have more control over industry. Actually, Brooks explains, quote, the real issue has to do with risk assessment. It has to do with the bloody crossroads where complex technical systems meet human psychology, close quote. He goes on to offer a line that Matthew Iglesias pointed out is largely cribbed from a 1996 New Yorker essay by Malcolm Gladwell about various psychological pitfalls that contribute to accidents. So what we really need to do is work on, quote, helping people deal with potentially catastrophic complexity, close quote, so we can, quote, improve the choice architecture, close quote. Meanwhile, back on Earth, the Times ran a story May 27th headlined BP Used Riskier Method to Seal Well Before Blast, about how the oil company chose to use a cheaper casing for the well, even though this could lead to a buildup of explosive gases, as it seems did happen. Did BP make this decision because, as human beings, they have trouble understanding complexity? Or did they make that choice because they are trying to pump oil as cheaply as possible so they can maximize their profits? And does that suggest they need an outside authority watching over them to ensure that their money grubbing doesn't lead to disaster? Or would that be puerile?
Newsweek's website featured an article by correspondent Stefan Thiel, dated May 28th, declaring climate change to be uncertain science. Given the Reader's Digest condensed version of the global warming denialist case, Thiel refers to, quote, emails and documents suggesting that researchers cherry-picked data. and suppressed rival studies to play up global warming, close quote, without mentioning that after the media sensation, subsequent academic investigations cleared the researchers of wrongdoing. The Newsweek reporter talks about a U.S. scientist, quote, under investigation for allegedly using exaggerated climate data to obtain public funds, close quote, without mentioning that the scientist, Michael Mann, is being investigated by Virginia's Tea Party-aligned Attorney General, Ken Cuccinelli, whom the Washington Post has described as having declared war on reality. Thiel also claims that there's a real scientific debate over the extent and time frame of CO2's greenhouse effect, while glossing over the fact that the debate in climate science circles is over whether the consensus predictions have underestimated how much and how quickly the Earth will warm as a result of the burning of fossil fuels.
There were protests recently at the Maryland homes of several bank executives, along with follow-up rallies in Washington, D.C. at bank branches and offices. The events, organized by the National People's Action and the SEIU, went largely uncovered by the local daily, The Washington Post, which led Post Ombud Andrew Alexander to wonder why the paper missed a major labor and activism story that was covered by Mother Jones and The Nation, among others. But when you read how Alexander imagines the paper might have approached the story, you might be glad they didn't do more. Wrote Alexander, quote, there were numerous ways the Post could have gotten back in the game on the story. For example, how did Chevy Chase neighbors react? Did protesters break trespass laws? When does First Amendment expression infringe on residential privacy? Does President Obama, who enjoyed SEIU electoral support, sanction these types of protests? And is a blitz on private residences a new protest tactic? Close quote. Gee, somewhere in there he could have suggested a few differently angled questions, like, what were the protesters talking about? Do their complaints about excessive cronyism between Wall Street and Washington have foundation? And did people's loss of their homes, jobs, and retirement savings ever interrupt their dinner time? Just some ideas.
And finally, witless commentary and breathtaking hypocrisy are no strangers to Fox News, but Bill O'Reilly was in rare form on June 1st, discussing Joe McGinnis, the journalist who moved next door to Sarah Palin's family home in Alaska in order to write about her. O'Reilly declared the move immoral and maybe even unconstitutional. He's talking here to Bernie Goldberg.
He is intruding upon her life and the life of her family. He's doing that. That, without a doubt, by his presence there, a malevolent presence for them, because they know he's going to do right bad things about them. He's intruding right upon them, all right? Their pursuit of happiness, which is guaranteed by the Constitution, basically has dropped 100% because he's there. And it's all, and you use the word creepy. I'm in a public eye, and if there's somebody who doesn't like me around my home, I call the police. Yeah. I call the police.
Right. The pursuit of happiness phrase actually appears in the Declaration of Independence, not the Constitution. About now, listeners who have followed O'Reilly's sordid career are probably recalling the Fox host's practice of having his camera crews ambush news subjects at their homes on vacation, even when they are with their children. In other words, intruding on them, all right? Of course, by O'Reilly's lights, only intrusions targeting those he cares about raise moral or constitutional questions. This is the beauty of being utterly unself-aware.
Thanks, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The New York Times called for Israel to end its blockade of Gaza, but the paper's reason seemed to be the blockade's failure to weaken Hamas as much or more than its success at impoverishing and punishing Gaza's 1.5 million people. Is this the best the U.S. press corps can muster in the wake of the storming of 6 humanitarian aid ships headed for Gaza by Israel's military commandos, killing at least 9 civilians and injuring many more? What ideas and facts are missing from mainstream reporting, and how could coverage be refocused? We're joined now by James Zoghbi, founder and president of the Arab American Institute, and also a co-founder of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. Welcome back to Counterspin, James Zoghbi.
Thank you. I'd say nice to be back, but it's actually sad to be back because when I'm on, it's because some horrific event is unfolding region.
Exactly. We were speaking with you in 2006 about Gaza, and I'm sorry to say I could almost have cut and pasted that interview into this one, so little has changed, certainly in terms of media. Well, in a June 1st report, the New York Times' Isabel Kirshner wrote, quote, "Despite sporadic rocket fire from the Palestinian territory against southern Israel, Israel says it allows enough basic supplies through border crossings to avoid any acute humanitarian crisis," close quote. I wonder what you make of the paper of record, if you will, contextualizing this event by saying Gaza is not in crisis.
They're reflecting talking points, liberal talking points, not the more hardline pro-Likud talking points. And pretty much the poles of the debate here in this country have wavered between the two. The Palestinian side of this narrative is not found and basically has almost never been found in official circles, and by that I mean mainstream press and among political leadership. So the best you do is you sort of get the argument that that you gave in the beginning about how the difficulty here is that it hasn't worked, it hasn't weakened Hamas, but it's only harmed the people. But not all that bad, because you know there's really no major crisis. It's just an inconvenience and a burden. The problem is that if you think about the way that's framed, there's no crisis because basic subsidies are getting through. What you've got is a strategy designed to limit the caloric intake of people in Gaza to bare minimum. And fundamentally, it's a racist concept. They've trapped 1.5 million people in a reservation of despair and poverty, and they allow in, like an eyedropper, enough to keep them alive. What you've got is 80%+ of the people today get their food subsidy simply from the United Nations. It's a welfare state. Secondly, you get 48% of the children in Gaza are anemic, and poverty levels have climbed into the 80% range. People are living in bombed out houses because reconstruction material hasn't been in. It's a disaster. But technically, the Israelis are right and the New York Times is right. People are surviving. And if survival is what's acceptable, then I guess the New York Times can be happy.
This has been a popular take on the assault that it on the boats, that it couldn't really have been about aid, the flotilla, because they get aid. I wonder, would other routes of possible access for materials in any event justify Israel's assault, to your mind?
No, I mean, look, the fact is that a year ago the president spoke in Cairo, encouraged the Palestinians to pursue nonviolence. This was a nonviolent approach. The Washington Post didn't get it at that. The Washington Post and some members of Congress made the argument that the Israelis were ambushed. I'm not quite sure that, you know, coming down from helicopters with black hoods and weapons out constitutes, you know, tripping into an ambush. But, you know, the fact is that this was largely a nonviolent effort. Sure. Some people attacked the folks who attacked the boat, but I think that's a purely logical response to fear, to anger, to frustration on the part of some. But what the Israelis have done cleverly is control the narrative. So this was an Al-Qaeda supporting ship. They used that language. The 50 people were Al-Qaeda supporters. They were extremists. Interesting that they ended up freeing them all and sending them away. I guess that means that Israel is now complicit in Al-Qaeda in letting go some of their terrorists. But that has been echoed here by Congress and by some of the newspapers who've argued, as the Washington Post did, that these were terrorist supporters and that they were a dangerous group of people. And the Israelis were defending themselves. That's the way that they shape the story, and that's the way the story ends up playing out.
Well, let's do a little bit of history here. The Associated Press reported on June 1st that, quote, "Israel and Egypt sealed Gaza's borders after Hamas overran the territory in 2007, wresting control from Abbas-loyal forces," close quote, that referring to Fatah forces affiliated with Mahmoud Abbas. Should readers accept that explanation, that history?
No, but if you control the history and define the starting point of the history, and then basically the rest of it flows perfectly. There was a civil war, and to some degree it was prompted by the United States that thought that we could encourage and support Fatah into winning, and Hamas ended up winning. You know, they'd won an election, they'd been punished for winning. I believe that Hamas behaved very badly once they won. They should have acted more responsibly as a government, and they didn't. But aside from that, the fact is that what the U.S. did was it couldn't take yes for an answer. There was a Hamas Fatah agreement on how to move forward in Mecca. The U.S. refused to honor the agreement. Aid was frozen. The closure of Gaza did not begin in June 2007. In reality, the closure of Gaza and the sort of the eking, you know, letting limited amounts of aid in and limited amounts of people out began in the mid-1990s, and it has continued ever since. It was a kind of a stranglehold in 2007, and it did come after Hamas beat Fatah in what had amounted to as a mini-civil war. The Egyptian role, however, needs to be understood, and it has not been understood, in part because Egypt is in a bind and doesn't know how to explain itself and feels awkward about explaining itself. I'm not a fan of how they've handled their situation, but nevertheless, the Egyptians understand that what Israel has tried to do is seal off Gaza as the occupying power, control the sea lanes, dominate the airspace, and control all access and egress, and then say to the Egyptians, you know what? You got it. It's yours. And the Egyptians have said, we don't want to take control of Gaza. Israel has the responsibility as occupying power. We're not willing to relieve them of the burden of dealing with this. And so the Egyptians are in kind of a bind. If they open it up and free it and link it economically and in every other way to their territory, then they're going to own it. And the Israelis will simply walk away, and 20 years from now, it'll be absorbed into Egypt, and it will have nothing to do with Palestine. Israel thinks in the long term, and the Egyptians are trying to avoid this becoming a fait accompli.
Finally, one of the things most characteristic of U.S. coverage is its focus on what the Israeli assault or even the blockade itself mean for U.S.-Israeli relations or for the Obama White House. We would always say, of course, it should start and end with human beings and human rights. But if we're going to follow that diplomatic angle, well, the news today says the White House finds the blockade untenable. That's not exactly a clarion call. Do you briefly see change in the U.S. role?
I see the U.S. today, 1 week later, being where they should have been on the first day, and they should have been evolving since then. They started in a horrifically ambiguous place. They end up a little bit better today, but they have a long way to go. The blockade has to end. Israel has to be held accountable for what they did, and the Palestinians have to be able to breathe free. All three things must occur if the U.S. is to deliver on the promise of the president's speech in Cairo. I don't hold any hope for that, but I think if there's any clarion call, it's that Palestinians should be free, the blockade should end, and Israel should be held accountable for its piracy and its murder on the open seas of 9 innocent people.
We've been speaking with James Zoghbi, president of the Arab American Institute and author of the forthcoming book, Arab Voices, What They Are Saying to Us and Why It Matters. Thank you for being with us today on Counterspin.
Thank you very much.
The U.S. detainment camp at Guantanamo is in the news again. On May 29th, The Washington Post ran a story about a new U.S. report that concludes that most of the remaining Guantanamo detainees should be released and recommending that only about a third of them be held for trials, military commissions, or indefinite detention. These findings, which echo earlier reports and studies, have not gone down well with many on the right, who insist on the old Bush propaganda line that Guantanamo is still home to the terror war's worst of the worst. Indeed, former Bush officials and supporters have mounted a formal campaign targeting the detainees and even the lawyers who have represented them. Joining us to talk about Guantanamo, the government report, and the right's response is Scott Horton. Horton follows the Guantanamo story closely at his Harper's Legal Issues blog, No Comment. Welcome back to Counterspin, Scott Horton.
Great to be with you.
Well, I'd like to begin with the detainees. This latest report is really concerned with the 240 or so detainees that have been held since Obama became president. But you did a story recently on your Harper's blog that looked at the disposition of all 779 detainees who have been held on Guantanamo since it opened. What did you find?
Well, it's really a fascinating case study because we find that 579 of them have been released, and most of those releases were by the Bush administration itself, which is a tacit exception of the fact that they shouldn't have been detained in the first place. And then with respect to the balance, we have a large number of habeas corpus cases pending. So far, we've had 50 of them decided, and the government has lost 36 out of those 50 cases. So that means 72% of the cases going against the government. And that's with respect to just the a little bit less than 200 remaining detainees who are not released. So that suggests that the government's case against the detainee population overall is extremely weak. Although we do have to recognize, after September 2006, President Bush took the worst of the worst who were not then held at Guantanamo, but in fact in black sites operated by the CIA, and he put them in Guantanamo. So those, since 2006, we have had a population of 16 serious terrorist offenders at Guantanamo.
Well, by now, there have been several studies and reports suggesting that the great majority of Guantanamo detainees were far from the worst of the worst. But the right won't let go of this. Former Bush aide Mark Thiessen, for instance, attacked the new government study in a Washington Post column that began like this. For years, the left has spun the myth that hundreds of Guantanamo detainees are really innocent goat herds and dirt farmers wrongly swept up in the war on terror. In an interview last year, Admiral A.T. Church III, the former Navy Inspector General who investigated detainee treatment at Guantanamo, told me this charge was bullcrap. Now, Thiessen goes on to say that that there's proof that 95% of those detained are confirmed terrorists. Now, of course, the Right's Guantanamo campaign is far bigger than a column or two. Could you tell us a little bit about the Right's campaign and why former Bush people like Thiessen, Bill Kristol, and the Cheneys seem to see so much at stake here?
Well, I think we have to go back to the original idea for Guantanamo. And we know now from documents released from the Bush era that as the original plan was formulated for this prison camp, it was designed to hold roughly 600 to 800 commanders, or serious leadership figures from Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And these plans were concluded early in 2002. And in fact, late in 2001, American forces believed that they had surrounded exactly this population, the people who should be held in Guantanamo, in two redoubts in Afghanistan. One was at Tora Bora, and the other, where the larger number were, was in the city of Kunduz. Kunduz was encircled. It was being bombarded. And then something strange happened. The U.S. bombardment ceased. An air corridor was opened, and Pakistani transport planes came in and evacuated out of Kunduz a number of people, probably about 1,500 altogether. We now know from information that's been collected from the Pakistani ISI, a large part of it the work of Ahmed Rashid, prominent journalist, that that included the 600 to 800 Al-Qaeda and Taliban leaders. In fact, the very people for whom the Guantanamo camp was built. Who authorized this evacuation? Well, we know the answer. Dick Cheney did. So Dick Cheney made the decision basically to allow these people to escape and hide out in Pakistan, and where most of them still are today, the target of this drone campaign. That's the dark secret that sits in the background of the Guantanamo camp's history. And in fact, the administration stepped in and began filling the camp with nobodies. I mean, with people who certainly were not the sorts of Taliban and Al-Qaeda leadership figures for whom it was built. And the Bush administration itself acknowledged that when it released 540 of these prisoners, the majority of the camp's historical prison population.
So are you saying that Thiessen, Bill Kristol, and the Cheneys are hanging on to this because they're afraid of that dark secret getting out? And tell us a little bit more about the campaign. What are Kristol and the Cheneys and Thiessen doing here?
Well, it's definitely vulnerability. In fact, I think if you look at Cheney and his own attempts to address this issue, he's always adopted the position that the best defense is an offense. But his position clearly is extremely defensive. He knows that there are the dark secrets, which are highly embarrassing to him. And I think this aggressive campaign is designed to cover. And Mark Thiessen, I think one of the fascinating points here, he is spending pretty much all his time working on this project. His work and his writing parallels perfectly work of the Keep America Safe group, which is headed by Liz Cheney and Bill Kristol. He writes column after column backing up what they do. How does Mark Thiessen earn a living? Well, we know when he left speech writing for the White House, he set up a publicist office, Oval Office Writers. He's not disclosed who his clients are, but I think if you look at what he writes and what he advocates, it's quite obvious for whom he's working. But he's not disclosing this client relationship, even though he seems to be devoting all of his energy and his writing at the Washington Post to the service of his clients.
Scott Horton, what is the lesson of the U.S.'s Guantanamo experience of letting the White House decide who our enemies are while discarding due process and the rule of law?
Well, I think the original concept of Guantanamo is a completely defensible and reasonable concept. That is holding 600 to 800 leadership figures there. The problems began when political figures began to dictate how it would be operated and move to a rejection of traditional military rules and military procedures. So it was this intense politicization of Guantanamo and the detention process that's led to all of our headaches and embarrassment.
We've been speaking with Scott Horton, a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and the No Comment blogger on Harper's website. Thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin, Scott Horton.
Great to be with you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you'd like more information about FAIR, you can find it on our website. It's fair.org. That's also the place to sign up for your free Counterspin bumper sticker. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.